bother replacing the broken cap. There was no need. Henry seemed almost like his normal self again, and I thought we both might get a decent night's sleep. "What do you say to sausage, beans, and cornbread?" I asked him. "Can I start the generator and play Hayride Party on the radio?" "Yes, sir, you can." He smiled at that, his old good smile. "Thanks, Papa." I cooked enough for four farmhands, and we ate it all. 2 hours later, while I was deep in my sitting room chair and nodding over a copy of Silas Marner, Henry came in from his room, dressed in just his summer underdrawers. He regarded me soberly. "Mama always insisted on me saying my prayers. Did you know that?" I blinked at him, surprised. "Still? No, I didn't." "Yes, even after she wouldn't look at me unless I had my pants on, because she said I was too old and it wouldn't be right. But I can't pray now, or ever again. If I got down on my knees, I think God would strike me dead." "If there is one," I said.
"I hope there isn't. It's lonely, but I hope there isn't. I imagine all murderers hope there isn't. Because if there's no heaven, there's no hell."
"Son, I was the one who killed her."
"No, we did it together."
It wasn't true. He was no more than a child, and I'd cozened him. But it was true to him, and I thought it always would be.
"But you don't have to worry about me, Papa. I know you think I'll slip, probably to Shannon. Or I might get feeling guilty enough to just go into Hemmingford and confess to that sheriff."
Of course, these thoughts had crossed my mind. Henry shook his head, slowly and emphatically.
"That sheriff, did you see the way he looked at everything? Did you see his eyes?"
"Yes."
"He'd try to put us both in the electric chair, that's what I think. And never mind me not 15 until August. He'd be there, too, looking at us with those hard eyes of his when they strapped us in and..."
"Stop it, Hank. That's enough."
"It wasn't, though. Not for him." "And pull the switch?"
"I ain't never letting that happen, if I can help it.
Those eyes aren't never going to be the last thing I see."
He thought over what he'd just said.
"Ever. I mean, aren't ever."
"Go to bed, Henry."
"Hank!"
"Hank, go to bed. I love you." He smiled.
"I know, but I don't much deserve it."
He shuffled off before I could reply.
And so to bed, as Mr. Pepys says. We slept while the owls hunted and Arlette sat in her deeper darkness with the lower part of her hoof-kicked face swung off to one side. The next day the sun came up. It was a good day for corn, and we did chores. When I came in hot and tired to fix us a noon meal, there was a covered casserole dish sitting on the porch. There was a note fluttering beneath one edge. It said, "Wilf, we are so sorry for your trouble and will help any way we can. Harlan says don't worry about paying for the harvester this summer. Please, if you hear from your wife, let us know. Love, Sally Cottery. P.S. If Henry comes calling on Shan, I will send back a blueberry cake." I stuck the note in the front pocket of my overalls with a smile. Our life after Arlette had begun. If God rewards us on earth for good deeds, the Old Testament suggests it so, and the Puritans certainly believed it, then maybe Satan rewards us for evil ones. I can't say for sure, but I can say that was a good summer, with plenty of heat and sun for the corn, and just enough rain to keep our acre of vegetable garden refreshed. There was thunder and lightning some afternoons, but never one of those crop-crippling winds Midwestern farmers fear. Harlan Cottery came with his Harris Giant, and it never broke down a single time. I had worried that the Farrington Company might meddle in my business, but it didn't. I got my loan from the bank with no trouble, and paid back the note in full by October, because that year corn prices were sky high and the Great Western's freight fees were at rock bottom. If you know your history, you know that those two things, the price of produce and the price of shippage, had changed places by 23, and have stayed changed ever since. For farmers out in the middle, the Great Depression started when the Chicago Agricultural Exchange crashed the following summer, but the summer of 1922 was as perfect as any farmer could hope for. Only one incident marred it, having to do with another of our bovine goddesses, and that I will tell you about soon. Mr. Lester came out twice. He tried to badger us, but he had nothing to badger with, and he must have known it, because he was looking pretty harried that July. I imagine his bosses were badgering him, and he was only passing it along, or trying to. The first time he asked a lot of questions that really weren't questions at all, but insinuations. Did I think my wife had had an accident? She must have, didn't I think, or she would either have contacted him in order to make a cash settlement on those 100 acres, or just crept back to the farm with her metaphorical tail between her legs. Or did I think she'd fallen afoul of some bad actor while on the road? Such things did happen, didn't they, from time to time? And it would certainly be convenient for me, wouldn't it? The second time he showed up, he looked desperate as well as harried, and came right out with it. Had my wife had an accident right there on the farm? Was that what had happened? Was it why she hadn't turned up, either alive or dead? Mr. Lester, if you're asking me if I murdered my wife, the answer is no. Well, of course you'd say so, wouldn't you? That's your last question to me, sir. Get in yonder truck, drive away, and don't come back here. If you do, I'll take an axe handle to you. You'd go to jail for assault. He was wearing a celluloid collar that day, and it had come all askew. It was almost possible to feel sorry for him as he stood there, with that collar poking into the underside of his chin, and sweat cutting lines through the dust on his chubby face, his lips twitching and his eyes bulging. No such thing. I have warned you off my property, as is my right. And I intend to send a registered letter to your firm stating that very thing. Come back again, and that's trespassing, and I will beat you. Take warning, sir. Lars Olsen, who had brought Lester out again in his red baby, had all but cupped his hands around his ears to hear better. When Lester reached the doorless passenger side of the truck, he whirled with an arm outstretched and a finger pointing, like a courtroom lawyer with a bent for the theatrical. I think you killed her, and sooner or later, murder will out. Henry, or Hank, as he now preferred to be called, came out of the barn. He had been pitching hay, and he held the pitchfork across his chest, like a rifle at port arms. What I think is you better get out of here before you start bleeding, he said. The kind and rather timid boy I had known until the summer of 22 would never have said such a thing, but this one did, and Lester saw that he meant it. He got in. With no door to slam, he settled for crossing his arms over his chest. Come back any time, Lars, I said pleasantly, but don't bring him, no matter how much he offers you to cart his useless ass. No, sir, Mr. James, Lars said, and off they went. I turned to Henry. Would you have stuck him with that pitchfork? Yes, sir. Made him squeal. Then, unsmiling, he went back into the barn. But he wasn't always unsmiling that summer, and Shannon Cottery was the reason why. He saw a lot of her, more of her than was good for either of them. That I found out in the fall. She began coming to the house on Tuesday and Thursday afternoons, long-skirted and neatly bonneted, toting a side sack loaded with good things to eat. She said she knew what men cook, as though she were 30 instead of just 15, and said she intended to see we had at least 2 decent suppers a week. and although I had only one of her mother's casseroles for comparison, I'd have to say that even at 15 she was the superior cook. Henry and I just threw steaks in a skillet on the stove. She had a way of seasoning that made plain old chew meat delicious. She brought fresh vegetables in her side sack, not just carrots and peas, but exotic to us, things like asparagus and fat green beans she cooked with pearl onions and bacon. There was even dessert. I can close my eyes in this shabby hotel room and smell her pastry. I can see her standing at the kitchen counter with her bottom swaying as she beat eggs or whipped cream. Generous was the word for Shannon. Of hip, of bust, of heart. She was gentle with Henry, and she cared for him. That made me care for her. Only that's too thin, reader. I loved her, and we both loved Henry. After those Tuesday and Thursday dinners, I'd insist on doing the washing up and send them out on the porch. Sometimes I heard them murmuring to each other and would peek out to see them sitting side by side in the wicker chairs, looking out at Westfield and holding hands like an old married couple. Other times I spied them kissing, and there was nothing of the old married couple about that at all. There was a sweet urgency to those kisses that belongs only to the very young. And I stole away with my heart aching. One hot Tuesday afternoon she came early. Her father was out in our north field on his harvester, Henry riding with him, a little crew of Indians from the Shoshone Reservation in Limbiska walking along behind, and behind them, old Pye, driving the gather truck. Shannon asked for a dipper of cold water, which I was glad to provide. She stood there on the shady side of the house, looking impossibly cool in a voluminous dress that covered her from throat to shin and shoulder to wrist, a Quaker dress, almost. Her manner was grave, perhaps even scared, and for a moment I was scared myself. "He's told her," I thought. That turned out not to be true. Except in a way it was. "Mr. James, is Henry sick?" "Sick? Why, no. Healthy as a horse, I'd say. And eats like one, too. You've seen that for yourself, although I think even a man who was sick would have trouble saying no to your cooking, Shannon." That earned me a smile, but it was of the distracted variety. "He's different this summer. I always used to know what he was thinking, but now I don't. He broods."
"Does he?"
I asked, too heartily.
"You haven't seen it?"
"No, ma'am." I had.
"He seems like his old self to me. But he cares for you an awful lot, Shan. Maybe what looks like brooding to you feels like the lovesicks to him." I thought that would get me a real smile, but no. She touched my wrist. Her hand was cool from the dipper handle. "I've thought of that, but..." The rest she blurted out. "Mr. James, if he was sweet on someone else, one of the girls from school, you'd tell me, wouldn't you? You wouldn't try to spare my feelings." I laughed at that, and I could see her pretty face lighten with relief. "Shan, listen to me, because I am your friend. Summer's always a hard-working time. And with Arlette gone, Hank and I have been busier than one-armed paper hangers. When we come in at night, we eat a meal, a fine one, if you happen to show up, and then read for an hour. Sometimes he talks about how he misses his mama. After that, we go to bed, and the next day we get up and do it all again. He barely has time to spark you, let alone another girl." "He sparked me all right," she said, and looked off to where her father's harvester was chugging along the skyline.
"Well, that's good, isn't it?"
"I just thought, he's so quiet now, so moody. Sometimes he looks off into the distance, and I have to say his name twice or three times before he hears me and answers." She blushed fiercely. "Even his kisses seem different. I don't know how to explain it, but they do. And if you ever tell him I said that, I'll die. I will just die."
"I never would," I said. "Friends don't peach on friends."
I guess I'm being a silly Billy. And of course he misses his mama. I know he does. But so many of the girls at school are prettier than me. Prettier than me. I tilted her chin up so she was looking at me. Shannon Cottery, when my boy looks at you, he sees the prettiest girl in the world. And he's right. Why, if I was his age, I'd spark you myself. Thank you, she said. Tears like tiny diamonds stood in the corners of her eyes. The only thing you need to worry about is putting him back in his place if he gets out of it. Boys can get pretty steamed up, you know. And if I'm out of line, you just go on and tell me so. That's another thing that's all right, if it's between friends. She hugged me then, and I hugged her back. A good strong hug. But perhaps better for Shannon than me, because Arlette was between us. She was between me and everyone else in the summer of 1922. And it was the same for Henry. Shannon had just told me so. One night in August, with the good picking done, and Old Pie's crew paid up and back on the res, I woke to the sound of a cow lowing. I overslept milking time, I thought. But when I fumbled my father's pocket watch off the table beside my bed and peered at it, I saw it was 3:15 in the morning. I put the watch to my ear to see if it was still ticking, but a look out the window into the moonless dark would have served the same purpose. Those weren't the mildly uncomfortable calls of a cow needing to be rid of her milk, either. It was the sound of an animal in pain. Cows sometimes sound that way when they're calving, but our goddesses were long past that stage of their lives. I got up, started out the door, then went back to the closet for my .22. I heard Henry sawing wood behind the closed door of his room as I hurried past with the rifle in one hand and my boots in the other. I hoped he wouldn't wake up and want to join me on what could be a dangerous errand. There were only a few wolves left on the plains by then, but Old Pie had told me there was summer sick in some of the foxes along the Platte and Medicine Creek. It was what the Shoshone called rabies, and a rabid critter in the barn was the most likely cause of those cries. Once I was outside the house, the agonized lowing was very loud and hollow somehow. Echoing? Like a cow in a well, I thought. That thought chilled the flesh on my arms and made me grip the .22 tighter. By the time I reached the barn doors and shouldered the right one open, I could hear the rest of the cows starting to moo in sympathy, but those cries were calm inquiries compared to the agonized bawling that had awakened me, and would awaken Henry, too, if I didn't put an end to what was causing it. There was a carbon arc lamp hanging on a hook to the right of the door. We didn't use an open flame in the barn, unless we absolutely had to, especially in the summertime, when the loft was loaded with hay and every corn crib crammed full to the top. I felt for the spark button and pushed it. A brilliant circle of blue-white radiance leaped out. At first, my eyes were too dazzled to make out anything. I could only hear those painful cries and the hoof thuds as one of our goddesses tried to escape from whatever was hurting her. It was Achelous. When my eyes adjusted a bit, I saw her tossing her head from side to side, backing up until her hindquarters hit the door of her stall, third on the right as you walked up the aisle, and then lurching forward again. The other cows were working themselves into a full-bore panic. I hauled on my muckies, then trotted to the stall with the .22 tucked under my left arm. I threw the door open and stepped back. Achelous means she who drives away pain, but this Achelous was in agony. When she blundered into the aisle, I saw her back legs were smeared with blood. She reared up like a horse, something I never saw a cow do before. And when she did, I saw a huge Norway rat clinging to one of her teats. The weight had stretched the pink stub to a taut length of cartilage. Frozen in surprise and horror, I thought of how, as a child, Henry would sometimes pull a string of pink bubble gum out of his mouth.
"Don't do that," Arlette would scold him. "No one wants to look at what you've been chewing." I raised the gun, then lowered it. How could I shoot with the rat swinging back and forth like a living weight at the end of a pendulum? In the aisle now, Akalois lowed and shook her head from side to side, as if that might somehow help. Once all four of her feet were back on the floor, the rat was able to stand on the hay-littered barn boards. It was like some strange freak puppy with beads of blood-stained milk in its whiskers. I looked around for something to hit it with, but before I could grab the broom Henry had left leaning against Fomonoe's stall, Akalois reared again, and the rat thumped to the floor. At first I thought she'd simply dislodged it, but then I saw the pink and wrinkled stub protruding from the rat's mouth like a flesh cigar. The damn thing had torn one of poor Akalois's teats right off. She laid her head against one of the barn beams and mooed at me tiredly as if to say, "I've given you milk all these years and offered no trouble, not like some I could mention. So why did you let this happen to me?" Blood was pooling beneath her udder. Even in my shock and revulsion, I didn't think she would die of her wound, but the sight of her and of the rat with her blameless teat in its mouth filled me with rage. I still didn't shoot at it, partly because I was afraid of fire, but mostly because, with the carbon lamp in one hand, I was afraid I'd miss. Instead, I brought the rifle stock down, hoping to kill this intruder as Henry had killed the survivor from the well with his shovel. But Henry was a boy, with quick reflexes, and I was a man of middle age who'd been roused from a sound sleep. The rat avoided me with ease and went trotting up the center aisle. The severed teat bobbed up and down in its mouth, and I realized the rat was eating it, warm and no doubt still full of milk, even as it ran. I gave chase, smacked at it twice more, and missed both times. Then I saw where it was running, the pipe leading into the defunct livestock well. Of course, Rat Boulevard. With the well filled in, it was their only means of egress. Without it, they'd have been buried alive, buried with her. But surely, I thought, that thing is too big for the pipe. It must have come from outside, a nest in the manure pile, perhaps. It leaped for the opening, and as it did so, it elongated its body in the most amazing fashion. I swung the stock of the varmint gun one last time and shattered it on the lip of the pipe. The rat I missed entirely. When I lowered the carbon lamp to the pipe's mouth, I caught one blurred glimpse of its hairless tail slithering away into the darkness and heard its little claws scraping on the galvanized metal. Then it was gone. My heart was pounding hard enough to put white dots in front of my eyes. I drew in a deep breath, but with it came a stench of putrefaction and decay so strong that I fell back with my hand over my nose. The need to scream was strangled by the need to retch. With that smell in my nostrils, I could almost see Arlette at the other end of the pipe, her flesh now teeming with bugs and maggots, liquefying, her face beginning to drip off her skull, the grin of her lips giving way to the longer-lasting bone grin that lay beneath. I crawled back from that awful pipe on all fours, spraying vomit first to my left and then to my right, and when my supper was all gone, I gagged up long strings of bile. Through watering eyes, I saw that Akalois had gone back into her stall. That was good. At least I wasn't going to have to chase her through the corn and put a nose halter on her to lead her back. What I wanted to do first was plug the pipe. I wanted to do that before anything. But as my gorge quieted, clear thinking reasserted itself. Akalois was the priority. She was a good milker. More important, she was my responsibility.
I kept a medicine chest in the little barn office where I did the books. In the chest, I found a large can of Raleigh antiseptic salve. There was a pile of clean rags in the corner. I took half of them and went back to Akaloas's stall. I closed the door of her stall to minimize the risk of being kicked, and sat on the milking stool. I think part of me felt I deserved to be kicked. But dear old Akaloas stilled when I stroked her flank and whispered, "Subas, Subasi Boss." And although she shivered when I smeared the salve on her hurt part, she stood quiet. When I'd taken what steps I could to prevent infection, I used the rags to wipe up my vomit. It was important to do a good job, for any farmer will tell you that human vomit attracts predators every bit as much as a garbage hole that hasn't been adequately covered. Raccoons and woodchucks, of course, but mostly rats. Rats love human leavings. I had a few rags left over, but they were Arlette's kitchen cast-offs and too thin for my next job. I took the hand scythe from its peg, lit my way to our woodpile, and chopped a ragged square from the heavy canvas that covered it. Back in the barn, I bent down and held the lamp close to the pipe's mouth, wanting to make sure the rat, or another, where there was one, there would surely be more, wasn't lurking, ready to defend its territory. But it was empty for as far as I could see, which was 4 feet or so. There were no droppings, and that didn't surprise me. It was an active thoroughfare. Now their only thoroughfare, and they wouldn't foul it as long as they could do their business outside. I stuffed the canvas into the pipe. It was stiff and bulky, and in the end I had to use a broom handle to poke it all the way in, but I managed. "There," I said. "See how you like that? Choke on it!" I went back and looked at Akaloas. She stood quietly and gave me a mild look over her shoulder as I stroked her. I knew then, and know now, she was only a cow. Farmers hold few romantic notions about the natural world, you'll find. But that look still brought tears to my eyes, and I had to stifle a sob. "I know you did your best," it said. "I know it's not your fault." But it was. I thought I would lie awake long, and when I went to sleep I would dream of the rat scurrying up the hay-littered barn boards toward its escape hatch with that teat in its mouth. But I fell asleep at once, and my sleep was both dreamless and restorative. I woke with morning light flooding the room and the stench of my dead wife's decaying body thick on my hands, sheets, and pillowcase. I sat bolt upright, gasping, but already aware that the smell was an illusion. That smell was my bad dream. I had it not at night, but by the morning's first, sanest light, and with my eyes wide open. I expected infection from the rat bite in spite of the salve, but there was none. Akaloas died later that year, but not of that. She never gave milk again, however, not a single drop. I should have butchered her, but I didn't have the heart to do it. She'd suffered too much on my account. The next day I handed Henry a list of supplies and told him to take the truck over to the home and get them. A great dazzled smile broke across his face. "The truck? Me? On my own? You still know all the forward gears? And you can still find reverse?" "Gosh, sure." "Then I think you're ready. Maybe not for Omaha just yet, or even Lincoln, but if you take her slow, you ought to be just fine in Hemmingford home." "Thanks." He threw his arms around me and kissed my cheek. For a moment, it seemed like we were friends again. I even let myself believe it a little, although in my heart I knew better. The evidence might be below ground, but the truth was between us and always would be. I gave him a leather wallet with money in it. "That was your grandfather's. You might as well keep it. I was going to give it to you for your birthday this fall, anyway. There's money inside.
You can keep what's left over, if there is any. I almost added, and don't bring back any stray dogs, but stopped myself in time. That had been his mother's stock witticism. He tried to thank me again and couldn't. It was all too much. Stop by Lars Olsen's smithy on your way back and fuel up. Mind me now, or you'll be on foot instead of behind the wheel when you get home. I won't forget. And Papa? Yes? He shuffled his feet, then looked at me shyly. Could I stop at Cotterie's and ask Shan to come? No, I said, and his face fell before I added, you ask Sally or Harlan if Shan can come, and you make sure you tell them that you've never driven in town before. I'm putting you on your honor, son. As if either of us had any left. I watched by the gate until our old truck disappeared into a ball of its own dust. There was a lump in my throat that I couldn't swallow. I had a stupid but very strong premonition that I would never see him again. I suppose it's something most parents feel the first time they see a child going away on his own and face the realization that if a child is old enough to be sent on errands without supervision, he's not totally a child any longer. But I couldn't spend too much time wallowing in my feelings. I had an important chore to do, and I'd sent Henry away so I could attend to it by myself. He would see what had happened to the cow, of course, and probably guess what had done it. But I thought I could still ease the knowledge for him a little. I first checked on Akaloas, who seemed listless but otherwise fine. Then I checked the pipe. It was still plugged, but I was under no illusions. It might take time, but eventually the rats would gnaw through the canvas. I had to do better. I took a bag of Portland cement around to the house well and mixed up a batch in an old pail. Back in the barn, while I waited for it to thicken, I poked the swatch of canvas even deeper into the pipe. I got it in at least 2 feet, and those last 2 feet I packed with cement. By the time Henry got back, and in fine spirits, he had indeed taken Shannon, and they had shared an ice cream soda, bought with change from the errands. It had hardened. I suppose a few of the rats must have been out foraging, but I had no doubt I'd immured most of them, including the one that had savaged poor Akaloas, down there in the dark. And down there in the dark, they would die, if not of suffocation, then of starvation once their unspeakable pantry was exhausted. So I thought then. In the years between 1916 and 1922, even stupid Nebraska farmers prospered. Harlan Cotterie, being far from stupid, prospered more than most. His farm showed it. He added a barn and a silo in 1919, and in 1920 he put in a deep well that pumped an unbelievable 6 gallons per minute. A year later, he added indoor plumbing, although he sensibly kept the backyard privy. Then, 3 times a week, he and his womenfolk could enjoy what was an unbelievable luxury that far out in the country, hot baths and showers supplied not by pots of water heated on the kitchen stove, but from pipes that first brought the water from the well and then carried it away to the sump. It was the shower bath that revealed the secret Shannon Cotterie had been keeping, although I suppose I already knew and had since the day she said, "He sparked me all right," speaking in a flat, lusterless voice that was unlike her, and looking not at me, but off at the silhouettes of her father's harvester and the gleaners trudging behind it. This was near the end of September, with the corn all picked for another year, but plenty of garden harvesting left to do. One Saturday afternoon, while Shannon was enjoying the shower bath, her mother came along the back hall with a load of laundry she'd taken in from the line early, because it was looking like rain. Shannon probably thought she had closed the bathroom door all the way. Most ladies are private about their bathroom duties, and Shannon Cotterie had a special reason to feel that way as the summer of 1922 gave way to fall. But perhaps it came off the latch and swung open part way. Her mother happened to glance in, and although the old sheet that served as a shower curtain was pulled all the way around on its U-shaped rail, the spray had rendered it translucent. There was no need for Sally to see the girl herself. She saw the shape of the girl, for once without one of her voluminous Quaker-style dresses to hide it. That was all it took. The girl was 5 months along, or near to it. She probably could not have kept her secret much longer in any case. 2 days later, Henry came home from school. He now took the truck, looking frightened and guilty. "Shan hasn't been there the last 2 days," he said. "So I stopped by Cottery's to ask if she was all right. I thought she might have come down with the Spanish flu. They wouldn't let me in. Mrs. Cottery just told me to get on and said her husband would come to talk to you tonight after his chores were done. I asked if I could do anything, and she said, 'You've done enough, Henry.'" Then I remembered what Shan had said. Henry put his face in his hands and said, "She's pregnant, Papa, and they found out. I know that's it. We want to get married, but I'm afraid they won't let us." "Never mind them," I said. "I won't let you." He looked at me from wounded, streaming eyes. "Why not?" I thought, "You saw what it came to between your mother and me, and you even have to ask?" But what I said was, "She's 15 years old, and you won't even be that for another 2 weeks."
"But we love each other!"
Oh, that loon-like cry. That milksop hoot. My hands were clenched on the legs of my overalls, and I had to force them open and flat. Getting angry would serve no purpose. A boy needed a mother to discuss a thing like this with, but his was sitting at the bottom of a filled-in well, no doubt attended by a retinue of dead rats. "I know you do, Henry."
"Hank! And others get married that young."
Once they had. Not so much since the century turned and the frontiers closed, but this I didn't say. What I said was that I had no money to give them a start. Maybe by 25, if crops and prices stayed good, but now there was nothing. And with a baby on the way?
"There would be enough," he said. "If you hadn't been such a bugger about that 100 acres, there'd be plenty. She would have given me some of it. And she wouldn't have talked to me this way."
At first, I was too shocked to say anything. It had been 6 weeks or more since Arlette's name, or even the vague pronounal alias "she," had passed between us. He was looking at me defiantly. And then, far down our stub of road, I saw Harlan Cottery on his way. I'd always considered him my friend, but a daughter who turns up pregnant has a way of changing such things. "No, she wouldn't have talked to you this way," I agreed, and made myself look him straight in the eye. "She would have talked to you worse, and laughed, likely as not. If you search your heart, son, you'll know it."
"No!"
"Your mother called Shannon a little baggage, and then told you to keep your Willie in your pants. It was her last advice, and although it was as crude and hurtful as most of what she had to say, you should have followed it." Henry's anger collapsed.
"It was only after that night that we..."
"Shan didn't want to, but I talked her into it, and once we started, she liked it as much as I did.
Once we started, she asked for it."
He said that with a strange, half-sick pride, then shook his head wearily. "Now that 100 acres just sits there sprouting weeds, and I'm in Dutch. If Mama was here, she'd help me fix it. Money fixes everything. That's what he says." Henry nodded at the approaching ball of dust. "If you don't remember how tight your Mama was with a dollar, then you forget too fast for your own good," I said. "And if you've forgotten how she slapped you across the mouth that time..."
"I ain't," he said sullenly.
Then more sullenly still, "I thought you'd help me. I mean to try. Right now, I want you to make yourself scarce. You being here when Shannon's father turns up would be like waving a red rag in front of a bull. Let me see where we are and how he is, and I may call you out on the porch." I took his wrist. "I'm going to do my best for you, son." He pulled his wrist out of my grasp,
You better.
He went into the house, and just before Harlan pulled up in his new car, a Nash, as green and gleaming under its coating of dust as a bottle fly's back, I heard the screen door slam out back. The Nash chugged, backfired, and died. Harlan got out, took off his duster, folded it, and laid it on the seat. He'd worn the duster because he was dressed for the occasion. White shirt, string tie, good Sunday pants held up by a belt with a silver buckle. He hitched at that, getting the pants set the way he wanted them, just below his tidy little paunch. He'd always been good to me, and I'd always considered us not just friends, but good friends. Yet in that moment, I hated him. Not because he'd come to tax me about my son. God knows I would have done the same if our positions had been reversed. No, it was the brand new shiny green Nash. It was the silver belt buckle made in the shape of a dolphin. It was the new silo, painted bright red, and the indoor plumbing. Most of all, it was the plain-faced, biddable wife he'd left back at his farm, no doubt making supper in spite of her worry. The wife whose sweetly given reply in the face of any problem would be, "Whatever you think is best, dear." Women, take note. A wife like that never needs to fear bubbling away the last of her life through a cutthroat. He strode to the porch steps. I stood and held out my hand, waiting to see if he'd take it or leave it. There was a hesitation while he considered the pros and cons, but in the end he gave it a brief squeeze before letting loose. "We've got a considerable problem here, Wilf," he said. "I know it. Henry just told me. Better late than never." "Better never at all," he said grimly. "Will you sit down?" He considered this, too, before taking what had always been Arlette's rocker. I knew he didn't want to sit. A man who's mad and upset doesn't feel good about sitting, but he did just the same. "Would you want some iced tea? There's no lemonade. Arlette was the lemonade expert, but..." He waved me quiet with one pudgy hand. Pudgy but hard. Harlan was one of the richest farmers in Hemingford County, but he was no straw boss. When it came to haying or harvest, he was right out there with the hired help. "I want to get back before sundown. I don't see worth a shit by those headlamps. My girl has got a bun in her oven, and I guess you know who did the damn cooking."
"Would it help to say I'm sorry?"
"No."
His lips were pressed tight together, and I could see hot blood beating on both sides of his neck.
"I'm madder than a hornet, and what makes it worse is that I've got no one to be mad at. I can't be mad at the kids because they're just kids. Although if she wasn't with child, I'd turn Shannon over my knee and paddle her for not doing better when she knew better. She was raised better and churched better, too."
I wanted to ask him if he was saying Henry was raised wrong. I kept my mouth shut instead and let him say all the things he'd been fuming about on his drive over here. He'd thought up a speech, and once he said it, he might be easier to deal with.
"I'd like to blame Sally for not seeing the girl's condition sooner. But first-timers usually carry high, everyone knows that. And my God, you know the sort of dresses Shan wears, that's not a new thing either. She's been wearing those granny go-to-meeting dresses since she was 12, and started getting her..."
He held his pudgy hands out in front of his chest.
I nodded. "And I'd like to blame you, because it seems like you skipped that talk fathers usually have with sons."
"As if you'd know anything about raising sons," I thought.
"The one about he's got a pistol in his pants and he should keep the safety on."
A sob caught in his throat and he cried.
"My little girl is too young to be a mother."
Of course, there was blame for me Harlan didn't know about. If I hadn't put Henry in a situation where he was desperate for a woman's love, Shannon might not be in the fix she was in. I also could have asked if Harlan had maybe saved a little blame for himself while he was busy sharing it out. But I held quiet. Quiet never came naturally to me, but living with Arlette had given me plenty of practice.
"Only I can't blame you either, because your wife went and ran off this spring,
and it's natural your attention would lapse at a time like that. So I went out back and chopped damn near half a cord of wood before I came over here, trying to get some of that mad out. It must have worked. I shook your hand, didn't I?
The self-congratulation I heard in his voice made me itch to say, "Unless it was rape, I think it still takes two to tango." But I just said, "Yes, you did," and left it at that.
"Well, that brings us to what you're going to do about it. You and that boy who sat at my table and ate the food my wife cooked for him."
Some devil. The creature that comes into a fellow, I suppose, when the conniving man leaves, made me say, "Henry wants to marry her and give the baby a name."
"That's so goddamn ridiculous, I don't want to hear it. I won't say Henry doesn't have a pot to piss in, nor a window to throw it out of. I know you've done right, Wilf, or as right as you can, but that's the best I can say. These have been fat years, and you're still only one step ahead of the bank. Where are you going to be when the years get lean again? And they always do. If you had the cash from that back hundred, then it might be different. Cash cushions hard times, everyone knows that. But with Arlette gone, there they sit, like a constipated old maid on a chamber pot."
For just a moment, part of me tried to consider how things would have been if I had given in to Arlette about that fucking land, as I had about so many other things. I'd be living in stink, that's how it would have been. I would have had to dig out the old spring for the cows, because cows won't drink from a brook that's got blood and pig's guts floating in it. True. But I'd be living instead of just existing. Arlette would be living with me, and Henry wouldn't be the sullen, anguished, difficult boy he had turned into. The boy who had gotten his friend since childhood into a peck of trouble. "Well, what do you want to do?" I asked. "I doubt you made this trip with nothing in mind." He appeared not to have heard me. He was looking out across the fields to where his new silo stood on the horizon. His face was heavy and sad. "But I've come too far and written too much to lie. That expression did not move me much. 1922 had been the worst year of my life, one where I'd turned into a man I no longer knew, and Harlan Cottery was just another washout on a rocky and miserable stretch of road."
"She's bright," Harlan said. "Mrs. McReady at school says Shan's the brightest pupil she's taught in her whole career, and that stretches back almost 40 years. She's good in English, and she's even better in the maths, which Mrs. McReady says is rare in girls. She can do trigonometry, Wilf. Did you know that? Mrs. McReady herself can't do trigonometry."
No, I hadn't known, but I knew how to say the word. I felt, however, that this might not be the time to correct my neighbor's pronunciation.
"Sally wanted to send her to the normal school in Omaha. They've taken girls as well as boys since 1918. Although no females have graduated so far."
He gave me a look that was hard to take, mingled disgust and hostility.
"The females always want to get married, you see, and have babies, join Eastern Star, and sweep the goddamn floor."
He sighed.
"Shan could be the first. She has the skills and she has the brains. You didn't know that, did you?"
No, in truth I had not. I'd simply made an assumption, one of many that I now know to have been wrong, that she was farm wife material, and no more.
"She might even teach college.
We planned to send her to that school as soon as she turned 17. "Sally planned is what you mean," I thought. "Left to your own devices, such a crazy idea never would have crossed your farmer's mind."
"Shan was willing, and the money was put aside. It was all arranged."
He turned to look at me, and I heard the tendons in his neck creak.
"It's still all arranged, but first, almost right away,
She's going to the St. Eusebia Catholic Home for Girls in Omaha. She doesn't know it yet, but it's going to happen. Sally talked about sending her to Deland. Sal's sister lives there. Or to my aunt and uncle in Lime Biscuit, but I don't trust any of those people to carry through on what we've decided. Nor does a girl who causes this kind of problem deserve to go to people she knows and loves. What is it you've decided, Harl, besides sending your daughter to some kind of an, I don't know, orphanage? He bristled. It's not an orphanage. It's a clean, wholesome, and busy place. So I've been told. I've been on the exchange, and all the reports I get are good ones. She'll have chores, she'll have her schooling, and in another 4 months she'll have her baby. When that's done, the kid will be given up for adoption. The sisters at St. Eusebia will see to that. Then she can come home, and in another year and a half she can go to teacher's college, just like Sally wants. And me, of course. Sally and me.
What's my part in this? I assume I must have one.
Are you smarting on me, Wilf? I know you've had a tough year, but I still won't bear you smarting on me.
I'm not smarting on you, but you need to know you're not the only one who's mad and ashamed. Just tell me what you want, and maybe we can stay friends.
The singularly cold little smile with which he greeted this, just a twitch of the lips and a momentary appearance of dimples at the corners of his mouth, said a great deal about how little hope he held out for that.
I know you're not rich, but you still need to step up and take your share of the responsibility. Her time at the home, the sisters call it prenatal care, is going to cost me $300. Sister Camilla called it a donation when I talked to her on the phone, but I know a fee when I hear one.
If you're going to ask me to split it with you,
I know you can't lay your hands on $150, but you better be able to lay them on $75, because that's what the tutor's going to cost, the one who's going to help her keep up with her lessons.
I can't do that. Arlette cleaned me out when she left. But for the first time, I found myself wondering if she might have socked a little something away. That business about the $200 she was supposed to have taken when she ran off had been a pure lie, but even pin and ribbon money would help in this situation. I made a mental note to check the cupboards and the canisters in the kitchen.
"Take another shorty loan from the bank," he said. "You paid the last one back, I hear."
Of course he heard. Such things are supposed to be private, but men like Harlan Cottery have long ears. I felt a fresh wave of dislike for him. He'd loaned me the use of his corn harvester, and only taken $20 for the use of it.
So what?
He was asking for that and more, as though his precious daughter had never spread her legs and said, "Come on in and paint the walls." I had crop money to pay it back with, I said. Now I don't. I've got my land and my house, and that's pretty much it.
"You'll find a way," he said. "Mortgage the house, if that's what it takes. $75 is your share, and compared to having your boy changing dieties at the age of 15, I think you're getting off cheap."
He stood up. I did, too. "And if I can't find a way, what then, Harl? You send the sheriff?" His lips curled in an expression of contempt that turned my dislike of him to hate. It happened in an instant. And I still feel that hate today, when so many other feelings have been burned out of my heart.
"I'd never go to law on a thing like this, but if you don't take your share of the responsibility, you and me's done."
He squinted into the declining daylight.
"I'm going. Got to, if I want to get back before dark. I won't need the 75 for a couple of weeks, so you got that long. And I won't come dunning you for it. If you don't, you don't. Just don't say you can't, because I know better. You should have let her sell that acreage to Farrington, Wilf. If you'd done that, she'd still be here, and you'd have some money in hand, and my daughter might not be in the family way."
In my mind, I pushed him off the porch and jumped on his hard, round belly with both feet when he tried to get up. Then I got my hand scythe out of the barn and put it through one of his eyes. In reality, I stood with one hand on the railing and watched him trudge down the steps.
"Do you want to talk to Henry?" I asked. "I can call him. He feels as bad about this as I do."
Harlan didn't break stride.
"She was clean, and your boy filthied her up.
If you hold him out here, I might knock him down. I might not be able to help myself."
I wondered about that. Henry was getting his growth. He was strong. And perhaps most important of all, he knew about murder. Harl Cottery didn't. He didn't need to crank the mash, but only push a button. Being prosperous was nice in all sorts of ways.
75 is what I need to close this business,
he called over the punch and blat of the engine. Then he whirled around the chopping block, sending George and his retinue flying, and headed back to his farm with its big generator and indoor plumbing. When I turned around, Henry was standing beside me, looking sallow and furious.
"They can't send her away like that!"
So he had been listening. I can't say I was surprised. "Can and will," I said, "and if you try something stupid and headstrong, you'll only make a bad situation worse. We could run away. We wouldn't get caught. If we could get away with what we did, then I guess I could get away with eloping off to Colorado with my gal."
"You couldn't," I said, "because you'd have no money."
"Money fixes everything," he says. "Well, this is what I say. No money spoils everything."
"I know it, and Shannon will, too. She's got her baby to watch out for now."
"Not if they make her give it away."
"That doesn't change how a woman feels when she's got the chap in her belly. A chap makes them wise in ways men don't understand. I haven't lost any respect for you or her just because she's going to have a baby. You two aren't the first, and you won't be the last, even if Mr. High and Mighty had the idea she was only going to use what's between her legs in the water closet. But if you asked a 5 months pregnant girl to run off with you and she agreed, I'd lose respect for both of you."
"What do you know?" he asked with infinite contempt. "You couldn't even cut a throat without making a mess of it." I was speechless. He saw it and left me that way.
He went off to school the next day without any argument, even though his sweetie was no longer there. Probably because I let him take the truck. A boy will take any excuse to drive a truck when driving's new. But of course the new wears off. The new wears off everything, and it usually doesn't take long. What's beneath is gray and shabby, more often than not, like a rat's hide. Once he was gone, I went into the kitchen. I poured the sugar, flour, and salt out of their tin canisters and stirred through them. There was nothing. I went into the bedroom and searched her clothes. There was nothing. I looked in her shoes, and there was nothing. But each time I found nothing, I became more sure there was something. I had chores in the garden, but instead of doing them, I went out back of the barn to where the old well had been. Weeds were growing on it now, witch grass and scraggly fall goldenrod. Elphys was down there, and Arlette was, too. Arlette, with her face cocked to the side. Arlette, with her clown's grin. Arlette and her snood. "Where is it, you contrary bitch?" I asked her. "Where did you hide it?" I tried to empty my mind, which was what my father advised me to do when I'd misplaced a tool or one of my few precious books. After a little while, I went back into the house, back into the bedroom, back into the closet. There were two hat boxes on the top shelf. In the first one, I found nothing but a hat, the white one she wore to church, when she could trouble herself to go, which was about once a month. The hat in the other box was red, and I'd never seen her wear it. It looked like a whore's hat to me,
tucked into the satin inner band, folded into tiny squares no bigger than pills, were two $20 bills. I tell you now, sitting here in this cheap hotel room and listening to the rats scuttering and scampering in the walls, yes, my old friends are here, that those two $20 bills were the seal on my damnation. Because they weren't enough. You see that, don't you? Of course you do. One doesn't need to be an expert in trigonometry to know that one needs to add 35 to 40 to make 75. Doesn't sound like much, does it? But in those days, you could buy 2 months' worth of groceries for $35, or a good used harness at Lars Olson Smithy. You could buy a train ticket all the way to Sacramento, which I sometimes wish I had done. 35. And sometimes when I lie in bed at night, I can actually see that number. It flashes red, like a warning not to cross a road because a train is coming. I tried to cross anyway, and the train ran me down. If each of us has a conniving man inside, each of us also has a lunatic. And on those nights when I can't sleep because the flashing number won't let me sleep, my lunatic says it was a conspiracy. That Cottery, Stoppenhauser, and the Farrington shyster were all in it together. I know better, of course, at least in daylight. Cottery and Mr. Attorney Lester might have had a talk with Stoppenhauser later on, after I did what I did. But it was surely innocent to begin with. Stoppenhauser was actually trying to help me out and do a little business for Home Bank and Trust, of course. But when Harlan or Lester, or both of them together, saw an opportunity, they took it. The conniving man out-connived. How do you like that? By then I hardly cared because by then I'd lost my son. But do you know who I really blame? Arlette. Yes. Because it was she who left those two bills inside her red whore's hat for me to find. And do you see how fiendishly clever she was? Because it wasn't the 40 that did me in. It was the money between that and what Cottery demanded for his pregnant daughter's tutor. What he wanted so she could study Latin and keep up with her trigonometry. 35. I thought about the money he wanted for the tutor all the rest of that week, and over the weekend, too. Sometimes I took out those two bills. I had unfolded them, but the creases still remained, and studied at them. On Sunday night, I made my decision. I told Henry that he'd have to take the Model T to school on Monday. I had to go to Hemingford home and see Mr. Stoppenhauser at the bank about a shorty loan. A small one, just $35. What for? Henry was sitting at the window and looking moodily out at the darkening west field. I told him. I thought it would start another argument about Shannon, and in a way I wanted that. He'd said nothing about her all week, although I knew Shan was gone. Mert Donovan had told me when he came by for a load of seed corn. "Went off to some fancy school back in Omaha," he said. "Well, more power to her, that's what I think. If they're going to vote, they better learn. Although," he added after a moment's cogitation, "mine does what I tell her. She better, if she knows what's good for her." If I knew she was gone, Henry also knew, and probably before I did. School children are enthusiastic gossips. But he had said nothing. I suppose I was trying to give him a reason to let out all the hurt and recrimination. It wouldn't be pleasant, but in the long run it might be beneficial. Neither a sore on the forehead or in the brain behind the forehead should be allowed to fester. If they do, the infection is likely to spread. But he only grunted at the news. So I decided to poke a little harder. "You and I are going to split the payback," I said. "It's apt to come to no more than $38 if we retire the loan by Christmas. That's 19 apiece. I'll take yours out of your choring money." Surely I thought this would result in a flood of anger. But it brought only another surly little grunt, He didn't even argue about having to take the Model T to school, although he said the other kids made fun of it, calling it Hank's ass-breaker.
"Son?"
"What?
Are you all right?"
He turned to me and smiled. His lips moved around, at least.
"I'm fine. Good luck at the bank tomorrow, Papa. I'm going to bed."
As he stood up, I said, "Will you give me a little kiss?" He kissed my cheek. It was the last one. He took the T to school, and I drove the truck to Hemmingford home, where Mr. Stoppenhauser brought me into his office after a mere 5-minute wait. I explained what I needed, but declined to say what I needed it for, only citing personal reasons. I thought for such a piddling amount I would not need to be more specific, and I was right. But when I'd finished, he folded his hands on his desk blotter and gave me a look of almost fatherly sternness. In the corner, the regulator clock ticked away quiet slices of time. On the street, considerably louder, came the blat of an engine. It stopped. There was silence. And then another engine started up. Was that my son, first arriving in the Model T and then stealing my truck? There's no way I can know for sure, but I think it was.
"Wilf," Mr. Stoppenhauser said, "you've had a little time to get over your wife leaving the way she did. Pardon me for bringing up a painful subject, but it seems pertinent, and besides, a banker's office is a little like a priest's confessional. So I'm going to talk to you like a Dutch uncle, which is only fitting.